continuing this morning our lessons on be involved in the church work, and we're going to look at the BE today. Remember from last week, the BEE standing for benevolence, evangelism, and edification. We looked at edification last week. I want to look at benevolence this week. Considering the time, I don't know if we'll finish it today or not. We may have to have some today and some next week. We don't have much time left, but we'll go as far as we can with what the time allows. Benevolence, simply stated, means doing kindness. It's just doing good works to others. And there are two different mindsets that come along the lines of benevolence. Most of us agree that any good work that can be done should be done. There are others within the churches of Christ who place all sorts of limitations on what good works can be done and by who they can be done and so forth. And we want to straighten out a few of those things with what the Bible says. And as I said, I don't know if we'll be able to finish it all this morning or not. Basically, everyone agrees that someone, an individual, can do whatever good thing with the money that's his that he desires. If I want to help someone buy food or help them pay their rent or whatever else I might desire to do with my money that's a good work, we would all agree that I can do that. The real difficulty comes in what can the church as a whole do? In other words, what can be done with the money in the church collection that's taken up? And there are those that contend that the only thing that can be done with the money that's taken up in the church collection is to give that to the saints, that only needy saints are eligible for that, and that we can't use that money to help anyone who's not a Christian. I believe the Bible very clearly teaches that to be an erroneous statement. Their main argument for that is, and this is a direct quotation, "I can't find one example of collection for the world in the Bible." Now let's think about that for a minute. I can't find an example of it, therefore it must be a sin. Now think for a second about all of the things that are in the church today or that are a part of our assembling together today that you can't find an example of in the New Testament. Here's one. You can't find an example of a microphone in the New Testament. You can't find an example of a church building in the New Testament. You can't find an example of a heater and air conditioning unit in the New Testament. You can't find an example of people coming to the assembly in cars in the New Testament. Does that make all of those things wrong? I believe the fact of the matter is, though, that we can find examples, and we'll look at three examples where the collective funds of the disciples of Jesus were used to help those who were not Christians or who were not even his disciples. We'll look at three examples that I think will show that that is the case. But we need to be careful when we say, well, we can't find an example of it, and so it must be wrong. Just because they didn't do it back then doesn't necessarily mean that it's wrong for us to do it. It may just be that they didn't have the means to do that. It may just be that that particular thing was not recorded. We don't have an example in the New Testament of a song leader. Does that make it wrong for us to have a song leader? No. In order for us to do things decently and in order, someone has to take the lead, don't they? Now, it'd be a mess if we said, oh, we're going to have song service right now, so any of you men that feel like y'all just you jump in and we'll start and have three men start three different songs at the same time. Wouldn't that be a mess? That wouldn't be decently and in order. We have a song leader because it expedites or it is expedient toward the goal of singing decently and in order. We have that for that reason. And I believe that using the collection of the saints for purposes other than just needy saints, which certainly we use it for the needy saints, and we'll look at Galatians 6:10, if you want to go ahead and turn there, we're going to look at that and explain a little bit about that verse. Certainly we use it for the needy saints, no doubt about it. But as an expedient, We can also use that money to help those who may be in need of the world. And there is a twofold purpose for that. One is to show the world our good works, so that they can see those good works and glorify God, our Father in heaven. The other is to reach out to those individuals so that they will be more apt to listen to the gospel and to come to Christ. So it ties in with that other E that we haven't talked about yet, the evangelism. That's our goal. We want to bring people to Christ. If somebody comes to you and they're starving, and we go, "Well, I'm sorry, we can't help you." You think they're going to want to then turn around and listen to you? "We can't help you eat, but we're going to sure teach you about the Bible." They're not going to listen. There's an old saying that says, "I don't care how much you know until I know how much you care." And we see Jesus using that principle throughout his ministry. He did good works first. He healed people. He fed people and taught them. But he showed them that he cared. We have to show people that we care. Now certainly, as I said, we know that individuals can do good works. That's not in question. That's not in doubt. Let's look at Galatians 6:10. Galatians 6:10 says, "As we have therefore opportunity, let us do good unto all, especially unto them who are of the household of faith." Now we see the especially there. And we understand very clearly, if we've got a choice, we've got one of our members is without food or without power or without gas, is coming up on wintertime and they don't have any heat. And then there's some stranger. And we've only got the money to help one. Which one are we going to help? Well, we're going to help our brother or sister in Christ, aren't we? Sure we are. Especially them. If it comes to a choice, we're going to help those of the household of faith first. Now, the argument that they make here is that the us, when he says, "let us, therefore," or "as we have opportunity," the we and the us, there are some that say, "Well, that doesn't mean the whole church. That doesn't mean the church collection. That means only the individual Christian." But now, you know, there is a phrase that explains if you're talking about the individual. In 1 Corinthians chapter 16, and verse number 2, Paul says, "Upon the first day of the week, let every one of you, well, that refers to each individual, doesn't it? Every one of you. So, there's no reason to think that this over here, when he says, "we and us," well, certainly as individuals, we should be involved in these good works. But there's no reason to limit it to individuals. If he wanted it to just be individual, he would have said, "let each one of us, as each one of us has opportunity, let him do good." Notice what he says, though. He says, "as we have opportunity, let us." Who's us? Let me tell you something. Tomorrow when somebody comes to me and they want gas money or whatever, I'm not us. I'm me. I would be the he. If he said, "let each one of us, as he has opportunity," then that would be me. Now, certainly, that doesn't mean that I can't help. I should, certainly. There's no doubt about that I should help. But he allows here with the words "we" and "us," he allows for the collective group to do something of purpose. Now, let's think about some of the inconsistency with this idea that the church collection can't be used for that. If the church collection cannot, if it's sinful for the church to use money taken up in the collection that's taken up on the first day of every week, if it's sinful for the church to use that to help someone who's not a Christian, then what do we do? I wasn't going to use a personal example, but I'm not. I'm just going to. What do we do if there's a member of this church who is married to or has family members living in the same household who aren't Christians? And that member needs help. Let's say their power is going to get cut off. They're going to be without heat this winter. They owe $200 in back bills because the bills haven't been paid. They've been out of work or whatever the case may be. And they need to. Now, what are we going to do? if we can't help that person who's not a Christian, what are we going to say to that brother or sister? Well, I'm sorry because your husband or wife, or because, you know, your mother is living in the house with you and she's not a Christian, or whatever, we can't help you. Or are we going to say, well, let's see, there are four of you living in the house, and two of you are Christians and two of you aren't, so we'll pay half of it. We'll just pay your half. That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. We're going to help. And it's the right thing to do to help. There's no reason whatsoever for us to... Are we going to start dividing that up? Oh, because somebody in that house isn't a Christian, we can't help? No, that's not right. That doesn't make sense. What's more, is when does it become a collective effort? If somebody comes to me and they maybe they need some help with their power bill, and maybe they've been behind, you know, they $300 they owe or something like that, and I don't have that much to do it myself, and so I call Alex up and I say, Alex, you know, I don't have enough, you know, I got $30 or $50, whatever, that I can pitch in. He said, well, I can pitch in another $50. I said, well, that's still only $100. They need $300. Well, we call Philip. Philip said, well, I can pitch in some. And we call Dick and Jason. We call different, you know, we call Addie and we call Maddie and we call different. And they said, well, yeah, I can pitch in. Or do we talk to the other and say, hey, can the church help do this? Which is more expedient? Which is going to get the job accomplished? At what point does it become a collective effort? If two of us, if Alex and I go in together and help somebody, is that a collective effort? If Alex and Philip and I, if Alex and Philip and Dick and Jake, how many people does it take for it to be a collective work? See, there's no consistency with the argument. Because I know my dad and my mother and father worshipped at a time before I was born with a church that taught this way, and he studied with them on this. Well, how many, would it be okay if I help? Yes, it's okay if you help, but the church can't do it. Would it be okay if I get five other members of the church and we all go together and help? Oh, yes, that's okay, but the church can't do it. Would it be okay if half of the congregation, we get them, half of the congregation together and yes, that's okay, but the church can't do it. Would it be okay if everybody in the congregation individually each gives $5 and then we take it and give? Yes, that's okay, but the church can't do it. What? That doesn't make sense. But it's ridiculous. The church just did it. And you're sitting there saying, well, that's okay, but the church can't do it. That doesn't make sense. And see, that's the problem when we have an inconsistent doctrine that doesn't mesh with what the Bible teaches. When you follow it out to its logical extreme, it doesn't make sense. Now, are we going to limit it? Yes, we just talked about Galatians 6:10. If there's a choice between someone who's not a Christian and somebody that is a Christian and we don't have the money to help, we're going to help them. Are we going to go spend all the money the church has so that aren't able to pay our own bills, you know, to keep the lights on at the building or things like that? No, we're not going to do that. We understand there are common sense limits, but when somebody is in need, we're going to help. Now let's look at some of those examples. First, we want to look at John chapter 12. Now, I realize that this is before the church was established, but Jesus and his disciples, were they not the founders of the church? Were they not the blueprint for the church? Did he not teach his disciples those things that were going to be in the church? Yes, he did. So even though this is before the cross, this is before the day of Pentecost, the church hasn't been established yet, I think we can learn some interesting principles from the way that Jesus and his disciples handled their money. And we can learn that we can follow... What are we? We're Christians, right? We're supposed to be following Christ. We're supposed to be like Christ. Well, then who better as an example for how to handle our money? Well, let's look at this. John chapter 12, we want to start in verse 3. It says, then took Mary a pound of ointment of spikenard, very costly, and anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the odor of the ointment. Then saith one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, which should betray him, why was not this ointment sold for 300 pence and given to the poor? Now right there it sounds like, oh, she should have just sold that and given it to the poor, right? So let's keep reading. Verse 6. This he said, not that he cared for the poor, but because he was a thief and had the bag. Well, what's the bag? Well, we know that's the money bag. That's where the money that Jesus and the disciples collected for their use was put. So he says, this ointment should have been sold for 300 pence and given to the poor. But what, was she going to give it to the poor? No, apparently it was going to go into their collective money bag. And that's the reason he wanted it sold, because he was dipping his hand in. It says he was a thief, and he kept the bag and bare what was therein. So whatever got put in the collection, Judas was the treasurer, so to speak. Never calls him that, but that's what he was. He kept the money bag. He kept track of the purchases and of the gifts that people gave, you know, for the work that Christ was doing, preaching and for his ministry. He was the treasurer, but he was a thief. And so he wanted Mary to sell that and give the money to him to put in the treasury to give to the poor. Now that right there shows the idea of a collective bag, right? That they had a collective source of funds. Okay, now, it doesn't specify which poor he was going to give it to. We might assume that, well, they were under the Jewish law, they were Jews, they were going to give it to the other Jews that were poor. Well, okay, we'll go with that, that's fine. But let's keep looking. Let's look back in John to chapter 6. In John chapter 6, we want to look at verses 5 through 11. Verse 5, when Jesus then lifted up his eyes and saw a great company come unto him. Now notice, this is a bunch of people coming. This is like, you know, maybe a bunch of people came to a gospel meeting. Doesn't mean they're followers. Doesn't necessarily mean they're disciples. I mean, they came to hear him preach. They wanted to hear what he said. They weren't necessarily his followers. It's just a great company came to him. Verse 2 said, a great multitude followed him because they saw his miracles. So, let's go on then. Notice what he said there then. The company comes unto him, verse 5, and he said unto Philip, one of the disciples, one of the apostles, whence shall we buy bread that these may eat? Where are we going to buy bread? Who's going to buy bread? We are. Where are they going to get the money? They're going to get the money if they could buy that much bread. They're going to get the money out of the bag that Judas is holding, right? That's the collection. And they're going to buy bread to feed all these people. See, by logic then, what these people that say we can't use the funds of the church for people that aren't members of the church, when we have a fellowship meal at our gospel meeting, people that aren't members of the church couldn't come. They couldn't eat that food that was bought with money out of the church treasury. That's exactly what Jesus is doing here. He's fixing to feed these people with money out of the church treasury, even though, you know, they're not the church yet, but it's the same concept, okay? And so, it's clear that he asked Philip, he said, where are we going to buy? Well, Philip then says, well, hey, we've only got 200 pennies of money and 200 penny worth of bread isn't going to be enough to feed these folks. So that's, you know, there's a bunch of people here and we can't buy enough bread. We don't have enough money. See, they were obviously talking about their collective funds that they had available. So then they find that a boy there had some loaves and fishes, and Jesus, of course, feeds them. But that's a very interesting passage there in John 6. Because Jesus himself asked, where will we buy bread? We are going to buy the bread to feed these people who weren't his disciples. Now, yes, they came to hear him preach. They came to hear him teach. But then notice what verse 26 says. Jesus answered them and said, verily, verily, I say unto you, you seek me not because you saw the miracles, but because you did eat of the loaves and were filled. He said, you're not following after me because you're my disciples. You're just coming because you want some more food. So again, Jesus points out that, hey, there needs to be a limit. You don't just keep pouring out your money. Well, there's the principle of stewardship there, isn't it? 1 Corinthians 4:2 tells us that a steward must be accountable, must be found faithful with the things that he's given. So certainly the elders and the treasurer as well, with the funds of the church, they have to be sensible about how they use those things. Let me also mention a couple others, and we're not going to go there for matters of time. But Matthew 14, verses 15 through 17, same thing going on here. Jesus is going to buy food from their funds that they have, the bag. And then also in Matthew 15, verses 32 and 38, same thing going on here in both of these other passages. One of them may likely be actually the same event that's discussed in John chapter 6. But regardless of that, there we have some examples of Jesus doing this that we're talking about. If Jesus can do it and it was right, that's a pretty good indication to us that it's okay for us to do it that way too. But people still say, well, you know, he was still under the old law and we've got to have a, you know, something after the church. Okay, fine. Let's turn to 2 Corinthians 9. If you want it that bad, we've got it for you. 2 Corinthians chapter 9. We want to start down around verse 6. Here, Paul is writing to the Corinthian church about giving. He's talked to them about it all through chapter 8. He talked about their generosity and these kinds of things. Chapter 9, so far he's encouraged them. He said, you know, hey, I boasted about how you were ready to give and all these things. Well, in verse 6 he says, but this I say, he which sows sparingly shall reap also sparingly, and he which sows bountifully shall reap also bountifully. Every man, here's the individual part, every man, according as he purposes in his heart, so let him give, not grudgingly or of necessity, for God loves a cheerful giver. Okay, so that's the way we're supposed to give, right? He's talking about the contribution, isn't he? We're supposed to give. Just as he said in 1 Corinthians 16, on the first day of every week, let each of you lay by in store. Okay, then he says, and God is able to make all grace abound toward you, that ye, having all sufficiency in all things, may abound to every good work. So here we're talking about benevolence. Every good work. He wants us to abound to every good work. Now let's go on then. Verse 9, as it is written, he hath dispersed abroad, he hath given to the poor, his righteousness remaineth forever. Now he that ministereth seed to the sower, both minister bread for your food, and multiply your seed sown, and increase the fruits of your righteousness, being enriched in everything to all bountifulness, which causes through us thanksgiving to God. Now he's going to shift gears. He's talked about our giving and our collection. Now he's going to talk about what's going to be done with that collection, with that giving. Notice what he says. For the administration of this service. So in other words, once it's given, then it's going to be administered. And if we understand the word administer, that means it's going to be dealt out or dealed out or whatever you want to. No, it's going to be given back out. It's going to be administered. It's going to be handled then. Here's the handling of it. For the administration of this service, not only supplieth the want of the saints. Wait, I thought they said that the only thing we can do with that money is supply the want of the saints. But he just said it not only supplies the wants of the saints, but is abundant also by many thanksgivings unto God. Now let's keep reading and see what he's saying about it. Verse 13. While by the experiment of this ministration, we assume that's the saints, because it was supplying the need of the saints. They glorify God for your professed subjection unto the gospel of Christ. Now notice the last part here. And for your liberal distribution unto them, these are the saints, we're distributing it back to the saints that have need, and unto all. So right there, he tells that the money he was collecting from the Corinthians was going to go back to Jerusalem, and yes, it was going to supply the needs of the saints, but he says, that's not all. He says, that's not the only thing it's going to do. It's going to, right, they're going to be thankful because you've supplied their needs. It's going to be a distribution to them and unto all. And this goes back again to the concept we were talking about earlier, that there were a lot of people in the New Testament times who came to Christ, and they had family members that may not have. Now, what are you going to do? You're going to say, oh, you're hungry? Here's you a loaf of bread. Don't share that with any of your family members that aren't Christians.
This is from the church treasury, and we can't feed those people, so you eat this and don't let them have any. Oh, come on. See, Paul makes it very clear here that the gifts that were given, the distribution of the money, was to the saints and to all. It was given to all. He goes on to say, and by their prayers for you, which long after you for the exceeding grace of God in you. So here again, we see the principle. Yes, as individuals, we can give. Yes, as individuals, we give to the work of the church. We know we're supposed to be doing good. Now here's the crux of the matter. We know we're supposed to do good. If we cannot use the church contribution to do good, then there are going to be some people who are going to be left out of being able to do good. There are some who, by the very limitations of their own funds, they give their money to the church, and they don't have any more to go out and give to their neighbors or to their friends or to whoever else might have a need. They just don't have any more. There is no more for them to give. They've given to the church, and we can use that money to help that individual be able to do that good that they couldn't do otherwise. The only other way that they're going to be able to do that good is to withhold some of their offering. That's not a good way to do it, is it? Never teach people to hold back from offering. God says we're supposed to give cheerfully. But knowing then that by giving to the church, they're helping the poor. Even though they themselves may not be in a position to do any help themselves, individually, through the contribution of the church, they can. What's more, James 1:27 says, pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this, to visit, or in other words, to take care of, the orphans or the fatherless and the widows. And how can we do that? We got somebody maybe who doesn't make enough money. They can't. They can't afford to keep an orphan or to keep a widow. They can't afford to do that. But by expedient, we can group our money together. And whereas one person might not have been able to afford to do it on their own, by all of us coming together, we can. And sometimes even one congregation might be so small that even all of the individuals within it can't afford. And so we cooperate with other congregations. To have a children's home where faithful Christians stay and we give them then supply their needs to watch the children and to help raise those children. Of course, there are some who may be able to take in foster children or even to adopt or whatever. That's great. But not everyone's going to be able to do that. But through the church and through the contribution that then can be given to those places, we can all help. And we can all be able to make a difference, even though individually we couldn't. Each of us can play a role through the collective giving. But though they say they can't find one example, we've seen three. There are three examples showing us that, yes, the funds of the church can and should be given to help those who need. And for what purpose? Certainly the ultimate goal of the church is singular. There is one goal that the church has, and that is to bring people to Christ. We are not just a social organization that goes out and helps. Hey, the Lions Club and some of these other clubs, you know, they do good works, and the church has a goal in mind. It's not just to help people. Yes, we want to help, but that's not the goal. The goal is to save their soul. That's where we really help. But in order to get the gospel to them, first, we've got to open the door. And many times the way to open that door is through benevolence. We saw Jesus do it. We saw Paul talk about the Corinthian church doing it. And we've seen that it has worked in numerous occasions throughout the time even that this congregation has been here, as well as other places in the world. So there are certainly some limits, but we have to understand the expediency of doing what makes things work the best within the limits. Let us, therefore, as we have opportunity, do good unto all men. Sometimes it's good not to give. In those cases, we do that good. Other times it's good to give. In those cases, we do that good. We have to use some wisdom in order to determine those things. Went a little bit over, but was close enough to the end that I didn't want to just leave a little bit for later next week, so went ahead and finished. If you're here this morning and you're not a Christian, you may need to become one. If you're here and you are a Christian, but perhaps you have not been living your life as you should, perhaps you need to straighten your life out in one way or another. We pray that you will respond to the invitation as we stand and as we sing.